content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, delivery apps just did the impossible. Silicon Valley is beating dominoes at its own game, by Adam Chandler. In recent years, Domino's has sometimes fancied itself as a tech company with a side hustle delivering pizza. It's true. By tinkering with technology such as AI, GPS, autonomous vehicles, and augmented reality, the world's largest pizza chain has turned the dark art of food delivery into a science. It all started with its fabled pizza tracker, which it launched in 2008 and created an early standard for tracking food delivery. Domino's now has something like 15 different ways to order a pizza, including voice assistants, Facebook Messenger, Slack, and a zero-click app that automatically orders for you after 10 seconds. All of this tech helped Domino's increase sales and streamline its operations, allowing it to finally out-pizza the Hut and become the facilitator of about a third of all pizza deliveries in the United States. Whereas other restaurants, pizza or otherwise, have become reliant on a constellation of third-party apps, Domino's keeps everything in-house, which means it comes out ahead. And theoretically, so do you. No Postmates, no problem. For $9.99 or so, plus a small tip, fee and tip, a Domino's pizza driven by a Domino's driver might show up at your doorstep within 30 minutes. But earlier this week, Domino's announced that it too would partner with a delivery app. By the end of 2023, the hangry masses will be able to place orders for Domino's pies and various sodium bombs through Uber Eats in most places, although Domino's drivers will still deliver the food. By joining forces with Uber, the company is acknowledging how dominant delivery apps such as DoorDash, Uber Eats, and Grubhub have become. Using them is approaching a necessary requirement for restaurants to stay afloat. If Domino's can't stay off the delivery apps, can anyone? Fittingly enough, the American food delivery craze actually began with Domino's. The company is often credited with popularizing the concept of pizza delivery. It created the modern-day pizza box, and co-founder Tom Monahan even met his wife while delivering a pizza. The delivery-centric Domino's model managed remarkable longevity, even as pizza ordering went from landlines to cell phones to dial-up to mobile apps. In 2011, not long after then-CEO Patrick Doyle embarked on an unlikely national ad campaign, conceding that his pizza kind of sucks, he issued a challenge to his technology team. He wanted ordering pizza to be as easy enough that someone could do it while waiting at a stoplight. Mobile ordering was the future, and in the future, pizza orders should only take 17 seconds. In a sense, Domino's has become a victim of its own success. The company's technological savvy helped prime the public for more than just pizza delivery. These 30 third-party apps appeared during the gig economy boom of the 2010s and then exploded during the early pandemic. Food delivery sales could have gone the way of Peloton as the pandemic slowed, but they haven't. Roughly 14% of pizza sales took place through delivery apps in the past year, alongside an array of dishes and cuisines that would make a diner menu look meek. As of 2023, hundreds of thousands of restaurants are on delivery apps, offering dry-aged steaks from fine dining spots and dry steak bagels from McDonald's. Restaurant dining rooms may be full again, but the apps are now pulling in more revenue than ever before. In other words, they've simply gotten too big to ignore. Even though Domino's will continue to deliver its own pizzas, its CEO, Russell Weiner, has put the cost of missing out in plain terms when discussing the Uber Eats deal. There's $5 billion worth of pizza sales happening on aggregator platforms that we should have a third of. With millions of restaurant workers preparing orders and millions of gig workers delivering for them, an entire food delivery ecosystem has coalesced, which has enormous implications for both restaurants and dining culture as a whole. These apps can charge restaurants fees that stretch up to 30%, imposing a burden that requires wild order volume to break even in a business that already has tight margins. They have so much power that they are now influencing the menus of restaurants, sometimes even if you dine in. The delivery workers making all this function, meanwhile, are still paid low wages as independent contractors with no protections or bargaining power. For diners, bringing tech even further into the restaurant industry has costs. According to a 2021 report, food delivery apps stand alongside the social media giants as the biggest collector and peddlers of consumer personal data. By Domino's own admission, Uber's willingness to hand over customer data was a key factor in its decision to strike up a deal with the company. Even as it becomes easier and more convenient to order anything to your couch, delivery apps will continue to force restaurants to bend their operations to suit them. That matters whether you order delivery every night or have never used an app at all. Next, this science story. Salmon seem to have a nose for beer, by Ben Goldfarb. Of all the traits that make salmon extraordinary migrants, their leaping prowess, their tolerance of both fresh and salt water, their attunement to the Earth's magnetic fields, the most impressive might be their sense of smell. Guided by the odors they imprint on in their youth, most adult salmon famously return to spawn in the stream where they were born. No one knows precisely what scents young salmon memorize, but it's probably some combination of mineral and biological signals, such as distinctive metals. Several years from now, however, if scientists at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center have their way, some Chinook salmon will be chasing a very different scent, the rich, beery bouquet of brewer's yeast. The alluring aroma of ale is a bid to solve a sticky conservation conundrum. How do you get hatchery-reared salmon to come home? Although the majority of salmon return to their birthplace to spawn, sometimes the fish slip up. A small portion naturally strays into other streams. From an evolutionary standpoint, says Andy Dittman, a Seattle-based biologist at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, it's an important alternative strategy that helps populations survive disaster and expand their range. After Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, for example, steelhead trout, a salmon relative, couldn't survive the ash-choked Tootle River, but bred in nearby watersheds. And as climate change shrinks Alaska glaciers, salmon have begun to trickle into newly exposed streams and lakes. But hatchery-raised salmon can take straying too far. Many hatchery fish are released in unfamiliar streams or in other conditions in which they don't readily imprint. As adults, these fish sometimes cruise past or never reach their home hatchery and instead mate with wild-born fish, distorting wild gene pools that have been finely tuned by natural selection. On the Elk River, this problem is especially acute. Some years, Dittman recalls, more than half of breeding fish were hatchery-born salmon that had wandered into wild spawning grounds. In 2016, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife tasks the state's Hatchery Research Center with solving the problem. Could scientists get juvenile hatchery-reared fish to imprint on a scent of their own choosing, one that would lure them back years later? Finding the perfect scent fell largely to the researcher Miriam Cameron. Much as Pavlov trained his dog to slobber at a sound, Cameron dropped various smelly compounds into tanks full of pinky-length salmon fry, then added food pellets to get the fish to associate the odors with their meals. If she could then add only the odor to the water and watch the fish still dart with excitement, she knew they could cue into that scent. Cameron tested a wide and occasionally weird array of aromas, among them extract of shrimp, tincture of watercress, skin of steelhead, and bile of minnow. She mixed and matched various proteins and hormones and phenaromes. You're trying things that will give the fish information, Cameron said. Is there a predator? Is there a mate? Is there food? What is the quality of habitat? In his Seattle laboratory, Dittman supplemented Cameron's efforts. He placed electrodes on the salmon's smell receptors, then spritzed them with Cameron's chosen scents to see how their neurons responded. Whatever odors we picked, Cameron said, we had to see if the salmon noses could actually detect it. After several years, a top candidate emerged, a cocktail of amino acids purchased from a commercial laboratory. In 2021, managers at the Elk River Hatchery released the first Chinook salmon fry imprinted on those acids into the wild, along with others reared on minnow bile and other compounds. Yet the amino acid mixture, for all its promise, proved prohibitively expensive to deploy in large quantities. So the quest for a cheap odor continued, which this spring led the scientists to beer. The idea came from Seth White, the director of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. White, an amateur beer maker, knew that brewer's yeast contains glutamate, an amino acid on which salmon are capable of imprinting, and he knew exactly where to find it in bulk. One day this March, White visited Newport, Oregon, where the brewmaster of Rogue Ales turned a lever on two vats of beer and poured out pitchers of Trub, the yellowish sediment of malt particles, coagulated proteins, and settled yeast that's left behind by the brewing process. White packed plastic bags of Trub in a cooler and drove an hour to the Hatchery Research Center. I felt like Ulysses on a quest, White says. His journey wasn't in vain. Dittman quickly found that young salmon are highly sensitive to the Trub. It seems to be a good candidate, White says. It's working out really well so far. Of course, it's one thing to get juvenile fish to imprint on an odor, and quite another to get adult salmon to chase it back to their natal hatchery. This past winter, the first males imprinted upon the amino acid cocktail began to trickle back into the Elk River, although scientists haven't yet analyzed the data. As for the beer, White says the Oregon Hatchery Research Center still has experiments to conduct before hatchery managers considering exposing their fish to Trub. If it someday succeeds, though, he already has a name picked out for the brew, Olfaction Pale Ale. Now, an ode to mood swings. If you don't like me now, just give it an hour. By James Parker. I've had three since breakfast, and it's not even 11 a.m. I've peaked, watching from my kitchen window a cat stare into a puddle. I've troughed, the impossibility of cosmic triumph. And I've bobbed in momentary equilibrium. And here you come again, my mood swing. Under the paving stones, the beach, under the shining moment, the banana peel. Up, down, ding, dong, round and round and round. I think you might be wearing me out. But I won't reject you. No, I won't repudiate you. I'm alive in America in the 2020s, and even-temperedness, emotional homeostasis, is neither attainable nor appropriate. Besides, it's always been this way for you and me. Ever since I saw Chariots of Fire, you, Aubrey, are my most complete man, said Harold Abrams, the driven, chippy Olympic sprinter, to his friend Aubrey Montague. Harold is on the massage table, heavy with melancholic self-knowledge, getting a rub down before his big race. You're brave, he tells Aubrey in a sad, horizontal voice. Compassionate, kind, a content man. That's your secret. Contentment. I'm 24 and I've never known it. Great scene. Thus was the binary implanted in my young mind in 1981. You could be a herald in this world, grasping and yearning and prickling and perpetually mood swinging, with a shot at a gold medal. Or you could be Aubrey, and I knew which one I was. But to be a herald all the time, all over your surface area? What's it for, mood swingers? Why did nature do this to us? I'll tell you why. Because she has her moods, too. Light shifts across the face of that puddle philosophical cat. The puddle changes color. And if I'm a failure today, I might be a titan tomorrow, or in 10 minutes. We are faithful, we who swing, to the humors of reality. That shaft of brightness, that spike of delight, will reliably fade. And at the base of the great gloom cloud, joy's little booster rockets are firing up already. So swing, mood, swing. Twang us madly between the high note and the low. Because if we're extravagant in our reactions, we are frugal in our stimuli. It really doesn't take much to set us off. A wet leaf, a guitar solo, a glad look. We are the lightweights. We are the cheap dates. Hard to live with? Well, yes, possibly. I mean, sure. But if you're not enjoying me right now, can I ask for your patience? I'm like a London bus. There'll be another me along in a minute. Now a story from the planet section. Summer in the South is becoming unbearable. Southerners are used to heat. We're not used to this. By Olivia Paschal. And this is written July 1st. A few weeks ago, as the first wave of smoke from the Canadian wildfires rolled south, I was getting ready to drive from Charlottesville, Virginia, about 18 hours west to my hometown of Rogers, Arkansas, to visit family. I figured by the time I hit the Virginia-North Carolina border, where I was planning to camp, I would have outrun the haze. But it followed me past the campsite and along Interstate 40 in Tennessee, all the way to my corner of Arkansas, just 20 minutes away from Oklahoma. The smoke felt much like these past years of extreme weather in the South have. Heavy, muddling, inescapable. This week, more wildfire smoke washed over Charlottesville and much of the South. Meanwhile, communities wilted under a heat wave, rattled from thunder, and flooded with rain. Towns in central Arkansas hit by severe thunderstorms last weekend were facing excessive heat advisories and worse than normal air quality by the end of this week. Last Monday, I watched hail batter my car. Within an hour, the sun was back out, and I was picking peaches in my friend's garden, pulling off my sweatshirt because the heat had become so fierce. Friends in Texas who were facing deadly cold earlier this year are now seeking respite from temperatures that threatened to hit 115 degrees. In some Texas cities, the heat index has surpassed 125 degrees, which is dangerously high for the elderly, the unhoused, and people who have conditions like asthma. Several people have died from the heat, including Tina Parrott, a woman in Louisiana, who spent days without power. Southern summers have always been hot and humid, but the swings from one extreme to the next, drought to torrential rain, record-breaking cold to sweltering heat, storm to sun, have lately begun to feel apocalyptic. Summer is our season, the South at its best, but this new reality has taken the best parts of Southern summers and made them unbearable. The extremities feed into one another. The heat breeds severe thunderstorms in some parts of the country and lights forests on fire in others. Homes and cars are damaged. Power is knocked out and people are stranded. Power has become a particular issue in Texas, where the grid has been stretched past its limits by cold snaps over the past several winters, as well as the current heat wave. Right now, the saving grace is additional solar power from the beating sun, aided by wind power. And when the lights go out or the pipes burst, families are left to deal with the continued and increasing heat with no air conditioner, perhaps no water. Growing up in Arkansas, I came to expect power outages during specific seasons, winter ice storms, March tornado warnings. These days, the disasters, because of what else can they be called, feel more frequent, less familiar. A tornado hit my parents' house in October a few years ago. Earlier this week, some friends and I tried to escape the heat by floating the Rivanna River and spent 3 hours drifting through wildfire haze, trying not to acknowledge that in escaping one hazard, we'd exposed ourselves to another. Climate change amplifies these disasters, and economic precarity exacerbates their impacts for many, especially the unhoused, the elderly, the incarcerated. Connie Edmondson, a 78-year-old woman in rural Everton, Arkansas, recently missed an electricity payment for her mobile home because she was paying medical bills for her heart and breathing problems. The heat had put her in danger before. Excuse me. She's had several heat strokes. Earlier this year, she passed out while she was mowing her lawn. A neighbor had to help her up and back inside and finish the mowing. If it hadn't been for legal aid and her doctor working together to persuade her electricity provider to turn the power back on before temperatures escalated again this week, she said, "I don't think I would have made it." The South is a region rutted with inequities, and every time the pendulum of climate change swings from extreme heat to extreme cold, it deepens the grooves. Laborers are especially vulnerable. The South's agricultural economy, propped up for centuries by enslaved black workers, now relies on farm workers, and because of lobbying by segregationist Southern lawmakers, those workers are exempt from the National Labor Relations Act. No federal regulations protect farm workers, who are mostly non-citizen immigrants from Latin America, commonly live under the poverty line, and have few legal rights from extreme heat. Farm workers die from heat-related injuries at 20 times the rate of other laborers. A 2020 study estimated that the number of days farm workers labor in extreme heat will double by mid-century. The state of Texas just rescinded rules requiring water breaks for construction workers, exposing them to greater risk of dehydration and heat stroke. For workers, the growing heat is impossible to ignore. Carlos Herrera Fabian is a 22-year-old who grew up in a farm worker family that moved up and down the East Coast, from Florida to Maine, picking seasonal crops. Back then, you could say that the heat was tolerable, he said. Now, it's just scorching. You can feel your eyes burning from the sweat dripping down. Fabian's 72-year-old grandfather, an undocumented immigrant from Mexico, still works in the Florida fields and comes home looking like he's just taken a shower, with sweat streaming down his body. Farm workers generally wear long-sleeve shirts and pants to protect themselves from sun and pesticides, exacerbating the effects of the heat. And they don't get paid when extreme thunderstorms keep people out of the fields, or drought ruins crops. Federal and state labor laws would help protect against these conditions. So would better infrastructure, power grids, tree canopies, cooling shelters, readily available water. The iniquities manifest in cities, too. Low-income, red-line neighborhoods have more concrete and fewer trees, and as a result, summer temperatures up to 20 degrees higher than wealthier, whiter ones. This is how it's going to be. Things will get hotter, storms will get worse, wildfire smoke will get more common, cold snaps will persist. All the while, the ruts of inequity will be worn deeper, the same people time and again placed in front of lines of catastrophe. Power grids will continue to fail, especially in states where the government is reticent to fund infrastructure, even for the wealthy and white, let alone for the poor, the rural, the people of color. The layering haze on hail on heat sometimes weighs so heavy that it can feel hopeless, like southern summers will never be southern summers again. And they won't. But together, we will try to stymie the damage. Olivia Paschal is a writer based in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the Arkansas Ozarks. She is a former editorial fellow at The Atlantic. We are out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.